Good evening and welcome to another episode of Nigeria Politics Weekly. As usual, my name is Michael and co-hosting with me is Phoenix. Today we have one guest. Our guest is Ilemona Onoja. Ilemona is a member of the People's Democratic Party, the PDP. We might get another guest. We don't know if he'll show up. If he does, then we'll announce him. But for the time being, we have one guest, Ilemona. The first topic we'll be discussing is the claims by the vice presidential candidate of the APC, former Governor Shettima, that Nigeria needs Abacha's hospitality and Tinubu has these qualities. Secondly, we'll discuss a report by SBM Intelligence, which shows that the number of out-of-school kids is significantly high. Thirdly, we'll discuss the news reports coming from Lagos that they've been auctioning off vehicles of traffic violators. And last but not least, we'll discuss Peter Obi's interview with the CNN that seemed to generate a lot of controversy or debate on social media. Now, Phoenix, onto the first topic. Do you agree that Nigeria needs a bachelor's hospitality? Is that what we need? And do you agree that Tinubu has those qualities? They call him, is it Emilokan? Is that how he's pronounced? Emilokan? Yes. So do you agree?
Hi, Michael. And hi, Lemona. Thanks for joining us this week. Hello, listeners. this is Emilokan. Anyways, we'll get you pronouncing it well in time. Don't worry. I don't know. I'm at a loss for words. But this their ticket just keeps. I find it fascinating in the sense that it's like a middle finger ticket to everyone. It starts first with you set up a ticket that first creates controversy around religion. You know, I mean, you don't balance the ticket in the normal way that everybody expects it to be balanced. You do Muslim tickets. You say, you did that because you believe that that's the right thing in your view. Then you go and stage the fast with all the fake bishops and things like that. And you get a VP candidate who comes with a lot of baggage. I mean, Shettima, it's amazing that anybody would even look to him. I mean, all the issues around Chibok and things like that. But let's even put that aside for a minute. You have their presidential candidate not show up. He hasn't been doing media interviews. He didn't show up for the NBA conference. Sends Shettima. Shettima goes there in his sneakers and his trainers and his suit. And then comes later to tell us that he believed that it was going to be a hostile crowd. And so he went there to stir them up further. And then you hear this gist that he's giving a speech in the Southern Heartland in Lagos, Yoruba Tennis Club, and begins to talk about past leaders, extolling military rulers, and he thought it wise in Lagos to talk about Abacha's hospitality. Now, anybody who remembers or even has an inkling as to what Abacha was like would understand that hospitality is the furthest thing. I mean, unless it was sarcasm, because the kind of hospitality that Abacha had is of the negative kind, in the sense that he was very happy to welcome people into his gulags. And of course, we also know that he had death squads sending, killing people up and down. I mean, you're in Lagos. You're in Lagos. A Lagos that has a major road named after Kudirat Abiola, who died as a result of this Abacha's hospitality. And you come here and be extolling his virtues. Now, of course, he then turns around. I don't know if you picked that up. He turns around and says he was misquoted. He didn't say hospitality. He actually said Abacha's taciturn approach and ruthlessness. But that's what he said, and that's what he meant. That, I mean, we don't need nice people to be leaders. I'm like, this shitty my guy. I think if it was even you, Michael, that put out a tweet that said, I mean, nobody should come and say that, had I known or something, because it's in full glare. You're watching it live as somebody is clearly showing his character. And then you have people continue to, you know, plump for this ticket that is just a middle finger ticket. They don't send you guys. They know their game plan. They intend to rig, use violence, do whatever they will do whatever it takes to get there. I mean, the theme of the ticket is exactly what you said. It's my turn. That's what Emilukon means. So they're like, I mean, they don't care. You see a presidential candidate, the person at the head of the ticket, Tinubu, coming out and telling us that he's not running for Nigerian Broadcasting Commission president. Because they are asking, when is he going to do live interviews and speak to Nigerians and blah, blah, blah. You're saying he's not interested in... I mean, it's just incredible that these guys can be in the running and just keep doing whatever they like. And I just want to see Nigerians, if they will let this thing happen and not hold them to account and not make sure they pay for this insouciance. And it's just incredible. I mean, but it's good. It's good because we must document all these things and make sure that if people do the stupidity that they did in 2015, I mean, this time, I mean, nobody will claim that it was from 1984 and therefore they didn't have information on it.
Ridiculous. Thank you. Thank you, Phoenix. You've described a new term, that the APC ticket is a middle finger to Nigerians. That's an interesting way to put it. I think I'm going to bring in Ilemona at this point. So, Ilemona, playing the devil's advocate, do you not agree that maybe Nigeria does need a leader who's ruthless and who can get things done, as Shettima says? Is there any merit to that? Is there a positive way to put it to people that yes, we do need a ruthless, decisive leader, Ilemona?
Hi, Phoenix. Hi, Michael. The thing about Kashim Shettima is that he's very well spoken. He's actually quite educated. And over the years has shown the ability to choose his words deliberately, which is the reason why once he felt he was misquoted, he came out to clarify. He knew exactly what he wanted to say. So that leads me to believe that if he wanted to say efficient, he would have said it. If he wanted to say result-oriented, he would have said it. If he wanted to use any of those other adjectives that give the inclination that what he wants or what he's advocating for is a president who gets the job done, he would have said it. In his speech that day at the Yoruba Tennis Club, he mentioned things about past military leaders or past Nigerian leaders. He picked certain things from all of them. When he spoke about Abacha, he spoke specifically about ruthlessness. He knew exactly what he wanted to say. And so when people misquoted him, he said, I know what I'm saying. And he stayed on point. He was not looking to describe efficient or effective or anything. He was looking to describe ruthless, the ability to make your opponents cower in fear or to take flight in preservation. Many people wonder why he did so, but I think it's also very clear. There are sections of this country where Abacha is still very much revered. I believe that this was an attempt to pitch directly to those sections of this country. I don't see anything else. He knows that if you, in certain parts of Nigeria, Abacha is still spoken of with hallowed tones and with respect, and people yearn for the glory days. And he was seeking to speak to that demographic, which is why, again, when he felt the message was getting lost, he came to correct you so that that demographic will hear the messaging. It raises all sorts of questions for me. Bola Tinubu's entire claim to being democratic first starts in his claim to being a member of NADECO and to have run into exile while he was fighting against Abacha's 5 years of tyranny. To hear his running mate describe Bola Tinubu in the manner of the self-same Abacha, he spent his years, so many years fighting. Wow. To hear Festus Keyamo, again, of NADECO, come out to say, yes, this is what we need. Wow. The Nigerian intellectual is a fraud. Because what was all that? All the time, NADECO, all that, what was it for? I also think that the timing of this thing in the Southwest was significant. He came with the intention that we will beat you people into line if we need to beat you people into line to support this ticket. So there was nothing that was a mistake about that thing. There was no mistake about the statement, about the clarification, about the intention. Absolutely none. Otherwise, why would anybody go to the Southwest, which was the hotbed of the resistance to General Sani Abacha? The Southwest, which was at the forefront of the fight for June 12th? The Southwest, where one by one, so many of Abacha's enemies were attacked, were jailed, were beaten, were killed, to go and make such a statement? The intention is clear. As a person who suffered personally from the effects of Abacha's reign, that statement is all the more reason why I will eloquently and aggressively campaign, not just campaign for my candidate, Alhaji Atiku Abubakar, but I will also actively and aggressively campaign against the ticket that Bola Tinubu is on. My father was detained between 17th of April, 1997, and 20th of December,
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Lemon, I think we've lost. Oh, yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we lost you for a few seconds, but you're back. Because you were just about to tell us your father was detained.
Because he was detained between April 17, 1997 and December 20th, 1997. Because as a shining star in the civil service, he had found a case of corruption to the tune of 5 million naira, which was a huge amount of money at the time, and he had reported it. He was picked up and he was detained, or he was picked up on the orders of Major General Tajuddin Olariwaju, and was detained at the Directorate of Military Intelligence in Apapa, under the supervision of Colonel Frank Omenka. One day we took food to him on a Sunday, and Frank Omenka met us there and put a gun to my mother's head and said, I would have killed you if today was not Sunday. I would have shot you in the head and I would have killed you and nothing would happen. And he knew that nothing would happen. Why? Because that was the sort of government that Abacha ran. For anybody to come back to this country to tell people like me, to tell people who suffered like me, to say to us that we need a dose of Abacha's ruthlessness. My goodness, if you guys did not, all the people who are listening to this, if you did not experience Abacha, I did. I saw the jubilation, first the fear. I'm speaking in hushed tones when news of Abacha's death broke because people were afraid. Then the jubilation that followed. I saw between 1993 and 1998, 5 years of terror. anybody. We do not have an excuse to allow a person who glorifies Abacha get back into office. We have absolutely no excuse. It is inexcusable. It will be unconscionable if we make a mistake such as that.
Thank you, Ilemona. Let me come to Phoenix first.
I'm sorry, my emotions are all over the place.
No problem.
That statement triggers me.
I have a question for Phoenix, then, and I'm going to come back to you with a follow-up. So firstly, to Phoenix, another thing people have observed is Shettima is supposed to be the running mate, and Tinubu is supposed to be at the top of the ticket. But it is Shettima who seems to be all over the place, issuing statements that some have described as threats, whilst Tinubu seems to be silent. Do you think there's a strategy behind this, or is it just Shettima going rogue? What do you think is happening, Phoenix?
I think it's clearly a part of the strategy. You need to look at what is Tinubu's path to victory. And I think Lemona touched on it perfectly. He needs to secure the North. He needs to secure votes in the North. And so, that's why Tinubu will allow for a Shettima to flourish more than you would typically expect a running mate to do. Because typically what you expect is that the running mate complements the head of the chair. But you want to know who the president is going to be. That's the person that needs to be speaking more. Now, of course, they are dodging behind, campaigns have not started. We only have 2 weeks left now. So we'll see what happens. But we're hearing a lot from this guy. This is the same guy that went to the NBA and told them that he will take care of security while Tinubu does economy. It's unheard of. It's unconstitutional. The post of the commander-in-chief is not shared with anyone. So to have him go around, making all these kinds of statements, being in your face, which is his character anyways. Anyone who's studied Shettima knows that he's not one to sit back, which is another point that I have made, and I believe a few others have made, especially when the choice became clear, that this is not someone who's just here along for the ride, or a vice president you're going to keep to the side, especially given the health conditions of Tinubu, although some have said that the Balm of Gilead is in Aso Rock, so who knows? Maybe he's going for his own turn at having his health turned around. But Shettima is not the guy that you're just going to expect him to just sit back and be your bank holder. So it portends an interesting dynamic for that ticket, and potentially they get in. But hearing him be out there speaks to how they expect to win. That is the path to victory for this ticket. It has to be that they secure significant votes in the North, especially because you have an Atiku who is on the ticket, who is on the ballot, and there is no Buhari. So the logical inference is that Atiku will sweep the North. But they need to show, to fight for that piece, that those northern votes, and that's why Shettima is out there making the noise, especially to make sure that Northeast comes to the fore. But to Lemona's point, the Northwest is a place where there are portions. In places like Kano, where Abacha is still spoken highly of, even our sitting president today speaks highly of Abacha. So, again, it could be a play to make sure that Buhari, supports, because we all know his insularity and his selfish being. He won't lift a finger to help somebody else. But maybe this is part of making sure that, he sees this as his people, and those in the Abacha camp reach out to him and get him to be on board to really help them with that northern vote. So for me, that's the game they are playing.
Thank you, Phoenix.
The response I want to have to that, and this is something that I think that we must look at, is it worth the play for the Southwest? Because obviously that sort of approach, I mean, we know that the Muslim-Muslim ticket is very unpopular also in the Southwest. It's unpopular in the North Central. It's unpopular in the Southeast. It's unpopular in the South-South and the Southwest. It's also unpopular in certain parts of the Northeast and the Northwest. But we know that that's unpopular on the one hand. Making such a bold pro-Abacha play, my mind tells me that they're willing to a certain extent to sacrifice certain parts of the Southwest, because there are people who are in the Southwest who such a bold, open, pro-Abacha play will be offended with, or who will be offended by such a bold, open, pro-Abacha play. While the whole country suffered under Abacha, everybody did. The Southwest in particular suffered as well. The Southwest suffered very badly. So I'm wondering, and I've been playing it in my mind since I had a conversation with a friend on Twitter yesterday, is it worth, you know, from a political point of view, that sacrifice that is following, is it worth it? Does that mean that there's a portion of the Southwest that is open to negotiating with one of the other big two, with one of the other two front-running candidates? My mind tells me that yes, because if you're coming to Lagos to come and threaten us Abacha-style ruthlessness, there are people there who will be triggered like I am triggered, and people who have far more significant clout, who are going to be saying, I'm not doing this with you. Okay, thus far, no further. Do you get what I mean? And I think what that does is that there are many people from that pro-democracy struggle, obviously much older than they are current, much older than the current trend-setting demographic, but who also still retain a certain amount of influence, who will say, nah, I'm not going to do this, and who will be open and willing to enter into conversations with either one of the other big two. That's what my mind tells me.
Lemona, just a quick one to that. I really hope so. But, you know, a quarter of a century is a long time. And what I've seen in Southwest politics is almost like, you know, that wave of Nadeko elders has dwindled significantly. And then some of the strong younger voices that kept that spirit alive have also gone, the likes of Joe Dumaki, for example. So the question now becomes, who are those that should be outraged? Because that outrage should have shown immediately. We haven't heard noise in the media. We haven't heard as much outrage as we should have in response to what he said. Even after he clarified and made it worse, how many people have come out to say something about it? So it seems like, you know, this era that we have seen, the Tinubu era, the money politics era, has created this idea of ends justifies the means. Let us get there first and we'll deal with everything else later. We can't get there on our own. We need to make sure we work with these guys. Let us get there. That's what I read into it, but I'm hoping I'm wrong. I'm hoping you're right that there are some people who will walk away. And let's see how it goes.
If there's anything that this thing signifies, it is how far Southwestern politics has fallen. I mean, from the idealism and the principles of people like Obafemi Awolowo and Chief MK Abiola and all the way to Bola Ige, you know, going all and seeing people who had an egalitarian worldview and who had a principled determination of how this country ought to progress, going from that to this politics of brigandage and thuggery and of a lack of values that Bola Tinubu presents and seeks to force, as he seeks to force himself on Southwestern politics as its greatest ever leader, is a shambolic shame.
Oh, no, thank you both for this. We need to move on to our next topic, which is also
about... Sorry, Mike. Sorry, Michael, I said Joe instead of Yinka. I meant Yinka with the Marquise.
Okay. Yeah, so the next topic is a report produced by SBM Intelligence, which says that the number of out-of-school kids is significantly high. And just looking at the map they've produced, my map reading, or I've never been really good at reading. I prefer to read words than data and sort of a spreadsheet or whatever this thing is called. But yes, it shows that Kebbi, for reasons I can't quite understand, seems to have the highest number of men and women, boys and girls out of school. Bauchi, too, seem very high. Zamfara, Yobe, all seem very high. Can you explain what's going on, Phoenix? Why a significant number of children across Nigeria out of school?
The failure of leadership, and this is not new, right? We've had this problem of lack of positive outcomes, because there's a lot of money that has been thrown at this. There's a lot of talk, you know. There's a lot of political talk around, oh, we're making basic education compulsory and mandatory. There's UBEC and all the money that has been thrown at it. But I mean, it's been a persistent problem, because there's no political will to solve for it, especially in those places that you mentioned. If you think about the lack of consistency in the outcomes, you see certain parts of the country quite low, especially in the south, and then you see in other parts that it is high. And so the question that, but for me, the real thing I'm taking away from this is that it is timely that SBM is pointing to this. Why? Because we're all caught up in the election for the president, which for me, I don't blame people. It is the most important office of the land. It is super powerful until we decide to do something about our constitution, you know, bring devolution, restructuring, and all those kind of things. So it is important that people, you know, are invested in determining who becomes president. But you solve for, it's not your federal government that is going to solve this problem. This is basic education. This is something that should be solved for at local government level, highest at state level. And so it is important that people are seeing this and holding those states that have poor outcomes to account. We've been talking about this for a long time. We've had this metric of over 10 million children out of school for a long time. We remember when the federal government tried to address this under Jonathan and built our Majuri schools in those places that you call, what was the outcome? Instead, they derided him, and it was even part of the things that they held against him in voting in, you know, getting him out of office. So it means that our people, wherever we are across this country, if we're interested in a better Nigeria, have to hold those state governments, local governments, know who's going into those offices and make sure that we're thinking down ballot and not just that one position. It's not enough, because this is what you get when you don't put in the right level of people. Now, it's good that we're pointing this out and showing it, but that's where the conversation needs to begin.
Thank you, Phoenix. Let me come to Ilemona. Ilemona.
Yes, sir.
Your party, the PDP, is known to, some say, boast on social media that we have a policy document for every solution. Whenever a question comes up, they say Atiku has a policy document. So what is Atiku's plan for out-of-school kids?
The way you frame this the way you frame this question is the framing of this question. Okay, but to take off from where Phoenix stopped, and before I come to the ethical plan, two things quickly jump at me. A lot of the places where these numbers are astronomically high are in northern Nigeria. So you have Adamawa above 30%, Bauchi above 60%, Borno above 50%. Sorry, was I reading? Okay, I was reading for girls. Let me correct that. So you have Adamawa combined just under 30%. Sorry. Bauchi just under just above 60%. Borno just above 50%. Gombe just above 50%. Jigawa, Kano, Katsina, Kebbi, Nasarawa, Niger, Sokoto. So primarily, a lot of these states are in northern Nigeria. That's the point I wanted to make. If you look at some of the states, you would realize that, for instance, Zamfara, Yobe, Katsina, you know, you'll be able to say, okay, Borno, you'll be able to say, okay, this may be a fallout from insecurity in the north over the course of the last 10 years. So probably that the security situation has exacerbated it, which makes me wonder. Boko Haram's stated mission is to end Western education in territories in northern Nigeria. So it begs the question, is Boko Haram really winning? If you have this number of out-of-school children, or these percentages of out-of-school children, is Boko Haram winning the war? It disturbs my mind to that extent. But to directly answer your question, what's the article plan? The article plan is very simple, to do one of two things. It's to do two things combined: improve the quality and improve access to education, to basic education. The numbers for the girls, if you notice, are higher. So there might be a little bit of a focus, a little bit more of a focus on the girl child, but also as much focus on boys as well. But the idea is to do one of two things: improve quality and improve access. There have been conversations, and it's one of the things that's stated somewhere in the policy document, that to be able to achieve this, you know, you've got to work with the states so they are able to tailor make, or to help the states tailor make policies that take their various local circumstances into consideration. But overall, the objective is improve quality, that is the quality of the teaching, the quality of the infrastructure, the quality of the learning experience, and then to improve access. If you're able to do those two things combined, you will progressively have better outcomes, and then the number of out-of-school children will reduce over a period of time. That is what the article objective is.
Thank you, Ilemuna, for outlining Atiku's policy plans. Hopefully, you can bring him on this podcast so we can ask him ourselves what he intends to do. But we must move on to our next topic because of time. Lagos State, Phoenix. I saw the news online that it was actually in the Vanguard newspaper that apparently if you're a traffic violator in Lagos, the government can seize your car and then auction it off. And there was the videos of people crying, begging and pleading these state government officials to give them back their cars. But those cars were sold to the highest bidders. So Phoenix, the policy generated a lot of debate on Twitter. A few popular handles tweeted that they'd lost family members who'd been killed because of bad drivers. So those drivers, quite frankly, deserved what they got. Is that your view, Phoenix?
No, I don't agree. I don't agree. I think, I mean, for as long as I have been conscious and aware as an adult, the sensible, reasonable refrain has always been punishment has to fit the crime. And so the punishment for a traffic offense cannot be that you are impoverishing people. It makes absolutely no sense to me. And there's no place where I've seen, so if you commit a traffic offense that leads to something else, leads to an accident that maims or kills somebody or destroys property, absolutely. Bring the book down for that specific crime. But a traffic offense, what you do is you have a significant enough, punishment in the form of, a hefty fine. You do community service, or you get points, rack up points that your license gets taken away from you, so you lose the privilege. Well, I'm hearing a lot of feedback. So,
sorry, I think that was me.
Okay, so you lose your right to drive for a period of time, and if you persistently, commit traffic offenses, you could permanently lose your license. But you don't take somebody's car away and go and auction it off at some ridiculous price. For driving one way or for beating a traffic light. Yes, it can lead to something bad. And that is why you progressively apply punishment to make sure that is that the person learns, or you take away their rights to be on the road in the first place. But the punishment has to fit the crime. You cannot impoverish people, especially people in Nigeria where people are really struggling, and say that that's because, some issues have happened. And for me, it makes no sense. Especially when we then start hearing allegations that of entrapment, that signage is taken off the road, they lurk in certain areas and act as if it's okay. And then when people, then do something, they then swoop and pick them up. I was even reading somewhere that someone was claiming that, just because their tires had turned towards the one-way road, they were arrested. Hadn't even entered or done the move, was still contemplating, but had turned tire. And so you're like, come on. We know that Lagos State in their IGI drive turned a lot of these things into money-making machines. But it's daylight robbery, because who knows who's picking up the assets during the auctions? Who knows whether they are using it to enrich themselves? But the bottom line for me is that the punishment has to fit the crime. And there is no traffic offense, pure traffic offense, not a traffic offense that leads to a more egregious, outcome or crime, like I was describing, but a pure traffic offense that entails taking someone's car that is worth millions and auctioning it for thousands of naira.
Thank you, Phoenix. Ilemona, I know you are lawyer called to the Nigerian bar, but these days you seem to have veered into politics. But I was going to ask you, in your legal opinion, because a number of supporters of the auctioning and seizing of cars have said the law was passed by the Lagos State government, so it's a valid law, and therefore people need to comply. And if you break traffic laws, then you have to pay the price. Do you agree with that? Is the law? It sounds like it's a terrible sentence, but is the law legal or constitutional, Ilemona, in your view?
Yes. Short answer, yes. It's a law validly passed by traffic management, or, what goes on within your territory on that score is within the ambit of the Lagos State government through the Lagos State House of Assembly to make laws for. It's very short answer. They've made a law. It has never been overturned. It has never been held to be legal, null and void, or whatever. So for the purposes of that, at least from a legal point of view, yes. But one of the first things that even in the university, you talk about the jurisprudence of law. You know, is it good law? Is it right law? It is law, yes. But we now need to talk about it more than it just being law. I'll give you a couple of examples about the toxicity of that law. Are you aware that under the Lagos State traffic law, it says neglect of traffic direction lights. I don't know what that means. Does that mean that if the light shows green and I don't move, I've broken the law and I face some punishment? It's vague. But what it says, neglect of traffic direction lights, is 3 months in prison. Imprisonment for traffic lights. Smoking a cigarette while driving meets with a fine of 30,000 naira and the impounding of the vehicle. Now, it doesn't say what happens after the vehicle has been impounded. Is it to be auctioned? Are you to come back and do something further to get your vehicle back? It doesn't say. Smoking a cigarette. Eating and driving. 3 months in prison. Now, let's talk about that particular one. Lagos State is renowned for its traffic. The average Lagosian who goes to work and comes back spends somewhere around 4 hours in traffic every day. So if you're in traffic and you as much as open gala to eat with La Casera, as much as that, you're committing an offense in Lagos State for which you can serve a prison term of up to 3 months. Wow. There are other things, you know. There are other things. Driving without roadworthiness, impound your vehicle, driving only yellow. I don't even know what that means. 80,000 naira, enforced painting. It says driving with hackney permit, impound vehicle. No, I think they meant to say driving without hackney permit, impound the vehicle. No display of hackney permit, impound the vehicle. You know, and so on. Driving a smoking vehicle, 30,000 naira fine. It raises a whole lot of questions. Speaking again from the legal point of view, in terms of actually securing convictions, it's very difficult because they adopt it's your word against ours. I mean, now they're beginning to install traffic lights here, traffic cameras here and there. But for several years, what happens is whatever LASMA accuses you of, you're guilty of. And like Phoenix just said, it is a well-known racket where they misdirect you down certain areas so that another team of people can go down there, pick you up, and extort you. What we are doing, and there's a plethora of evidence in the aftermath of this controversy, we have seen a lot of people post videos, or in fact, some of those videos have been there for a while, for years, but people have retweeted and reposted those videos that show LASMA officials collaborating and taking actions designed to mislead people so that they can be arrested and then prosecuted or extorted. The question that I've been asking since this information broke out a few days ago has been, are these the people we want to put into whose hands we want to put the power of determining if Nigerians lose their vehicles or go to jail or not? When there is clear and present precedence that shows the ability to manipulate evidence, to manufacture testimony, and to do so for the purposes of extorting Nigerians. While we're at it, we must also discuss what is the purpose of punishment? Is the punishment meant to rehabilitate, or it is meant to destroy? Punishment like this obviously destroys. There was one guy who caused actually quite a huge hullabaloo, who had been to, Vanguard reported that he had been to prison for 3 years. In actual fact, in a follow-up interview, he said he had been to prison for 3 months. I was one of the people who reposted Vanguard's version before I heard his version. And so this is me correcting it right now. It was 3 months. So he had been to jail for 3 months. He had had his vehicle taken away. Because he was in jail and because his vehicle had been taken away, he could not generate the funds required to treat his toddler, and she died. He still comes out of jail, and then his vehicle is auctioned. So he's had that jail term. He's had loss of a family member as a result of the impounding of his vehicle. It makes you ask the question, when is the punishment too much? At what point do you stop and say, hold on, this is too much? The answers that we've been getting and people saying all sorts of things about how, oh, he committed a crime, and whatever happens, he should take it like that, makes us realize how much we do not believe that people who are found guilty of crimes actually deserve some sort of dignity as provided by the Constitution. We don't recognize that. We believe that once you are guilty of a crime, anything and everything can be done to you, which is the reason why we have law enforcement agencies that treat Nigerian citizens anyhow, which is the reason why we have rampant cases of extrajudicial murder, because there is a general societal belief held in certain quarters that if you commit crimes, that there is no need for commensuracy between the punishment you receive and whatever government does to you. And I struggle.
Thank you, Lemona.
To accept that.
Sorry to cut you because of time. No, thank you for the points you have made. Although it's obviously it's quite disturbing to hear that people are being detained for minor issues, and let's hope common sense somehow prevails. Although, on a personal and lighter note, I do like to eat food, so I'm quite worried that eating and driving could lead to a 3-month jail sentence. So I'm personally concerned about that one. But anyway, to our final topic, Peter Obi. Peter Obi appeared on CNN, and his interview with Zane, I think her name is Zane Asher. Apologies if I've just made that name up. I think it was Zane Asher. Had an interview there, and that generated a lot of debate on social media. Some people said he did very well, whilst others attacked him, said his performance was shambolic. Now, Phoenix, I'm sure you watched the interview, and you're the podcast's resident obedient, as they call Peter Obi's supporters. So did you listen to the interview, and what did you think, Phoenix? And on a lighter note, I was just thinking about it. Peter Obi and Nyesom Wike seem to have different but yet similar voices. It seems like if there's a spectrum of that unique voice, I think both of them have it. But Wike is on the far left and Peter Obi is on the far right. They seem to have very unique interview voices. But anyway, yes, over to you, Phoenix.
You know, that thing about voices. I remember listening to one of Peter Obi's speeches, and my brother just said, who's that? Who's that speaking? And I said, it was Peter Obi. That Peter Obi's voice. You know that popular refrain that people say his voice has that very low, almost feminine tone. But anyways, that's and going back to the interview. No, I would not go so far as to say he did very well. I think he did well in the sense that, I mean, the questions that came to him, he gave his normal spiel. I think there's no doubt that we are all clear in terms of what he's thinking is, what he believes the solutions are. He's clear on the problems, he's clear on what he can do. He's always like, I'm running on my antecedents. I've been a governor for 8 years. You guys know what I said I would do when I became governor. and what I did, and the outcomes are there for you to go and check. And I'm saying that I will bring a similar type of governance to Nigeria. I understand the problems. I was a, you know, I was a member of the National Economic Council, or National Economic Council, like exactly, I don't remember what they call themselves. He was a deputy chairman of the Nigerian Governors Forum. He was chairman of the Southeast Governors Forum. He was an economic advisor. So he knows Nigeria. He understands the country, and he's defined the problems the way he sees it. And he on the interview, he was practically making the same statements. But what I've noticed is that when he's doing virtual interviews, he's not as fluent as when he's in person with the interviewer. Like if he's in a studio, you know, where he's physically in the same space. I noticed it also, there was one other interview that he did that was virtual like that. There seemed to be long pauses before he responds and all that. But if you pick exactly what he was asked and what he addressed and the points that he wanted to put across, they're consistent. Things around, you know, this is what the issues are, and this is how we should solve it. And we need people who have the right character, the commitment, the capacity, the competence, and the will to bring the change that needs to be brought to bear. And that's why, you know, I continue to believe that he's the right one to do it. But, you know, if I look at it stylistically in terms of how he's performed in other face-to-face interviews, I think that this is something that needs to be worked on by him and his camp.
Thank you, Phoenix. Let me come to Ilemona. Ilemona, Peter Obi's supporters responded angrily, and they said you PDP people in particular are always crying whenever Peter Obi says something that you don't criticize the government, you're always quiet. But the moment Peter Obi gives an interview, you guys suddenly find your energy and start analyzing him like he's the president, that your own candidate Atiku should also go and be interviewed by CNN. So, and if Atiku is not going to be interviewed by CNN, then you guys should keep your opinions to yourselves. So how do you respond to this, Ilemona, these allegations?
First of all, I share certain opinions with obedience, so to speak. But I would say, start by saying, anybody who says that members of the PDP do not criticize the government is not telling the truth, short and simple. Anybody who says that, we've been critical of the APC-led federal government since it was sworn into office on May 29th, 2015. Even when at the time it seemed unfashionable to do so. We've been critical, we've taken time, we've pointed out failure after failure after failure. Failure in action, failure of policy, failure of character, whatever be the case, we have taken time. We've done it on the streets, we've done it on radio, we've done it on television, we've done it on the pages of the newspapers, we've done it on social media, and we've done so consistently for years. Anybody who says that members of the PDP, supporters of our presidential candidate, Alhaji Atiku Abubakar, do not point out the failure of the government is telling, pure and simple, is telling a lie. So let's quickly get that out of the way. I also think that we're in election season. We're trying constantly to show that the plans, policy projections, and policy propositions of our preferred candidates are the best on offer at the moment. What that means is we will speak about anybody who speaks about plans. Any plans, we will speak about them. There are people who commend some of those plans. There are people who commend some of Peter Obi's plans. There are people, and when I say people, I mean people from the PDP. There are people who avoid conversation about Peter Obi in general. because up until not very long ago, he was a member of the PDP. He'd been given several opportunities and was given the opportunity of being ticket holder for the second highest office in the land. And we, at the time, as we do now, at the time, we believed that he was suitable for high office. So if we say we disagree, okay, there's a difference between your policy projection and ours, given that you've taken a different tangent, I don't see why that is a source of angst. I don't see why it should be. I will personally draw the line, and on more than one occasion I've asked people on my side of the divide to sort of refrain from seemingly personal attacks. I believe that it is unnecessary. But we can and we must discuss policy. So if you're doing an interview where you make a policy proposition and we disagree with it, why should we not talk about it? Plus, the people who are obedient, who say PDP members shouldn't speak about Peter Obi's policy propositions, are also hypocritical because they spend almost all their waking moments speaking about the PDP. At the beginning of this conversation, when you said, or you made the remark about the Atiku policy document, a lot of obedience spend a considerable amount of time criticizing it, spend a considerable amount of time mocking it. So I wonder how you take that position when you are in fact doing the same thing yourself. It makes no sense to me. I believe that what we need to do is keep it cleaner, but debates around policy propositions by presidential candidates, by candidates in any election, is not only a good thing, it is a necessary thing. That's the only way that we're going to be able to, you know, to sift through and determine who is better for us at the helm of our affairs than all the others. It brings me to the interview. I think I've seen better interviews that he's had. I think that he did not take advantage of, and we must admit, doing an interview on CNN is an opportunity. I don't believe that he took advantage of the opportunity that it could have been. I think that, yeah, while he always comes across as understanding what the problems are, and eloquently explaining, you know, his understanding of those problems, I think that the interview was very light on details of how to get there. There was a lot of, you know, these are the problems, but how do we get to the stated solutions? I didn't see much that was new, considering that we've heard some of his answers before. There was nothing that was new. There was nothing that was groundbreaking. I still, where I am, disagree on matters of policy, you know, and I don't think it was a very great interview, to be honest.
Oh, thank you, Lemona. Phoenix, did you hear that they said Peter Obi's interview with CNN was not great at all? And Lemona has also said that it is you, obedience, who are constantly harassing their party, telling them that Atiku's policy document is obsolete. But somehow, when they return fire, you guys start claiming that PDP members are tormenting you. So, how do you respond to this, Phoenix? Are you the people harassing PDP members?
When it comes to Lemona, him and I, we know what we're talking about, and we know that the transfer window is still open, so we let him get away with a few things. But I'll respond to say that first of all, we know that it's certain elements within the PDP who you see, the issue is this: when they come for Peter Obi, it's never on the basis of, you know, he is incompetent or he's incapable of doing this, or he it's always looking for, you know, very weird things that you expect. And that's why, that's where, when I see the, when I see the back and forth between obedience and PDP people, I just, for me, I find it amusing. Because PDP, the kind of things that they throw at him are the things that you expect the APC to do, because they are the ones that play this low-level politics. That's their MO. But then when you see PDP trying to, for instance, you know, they'll be playing games like Peter Obi put state money in his family business, or Pandora, you know, things that have no basis are some of the things that you see them do. And that's what triggers the back and forth that they have. Nobody today, you can say that, yes, he hasn't put a document in some websites that you can go and read. But to say that we don't have a clear idea of Peter Obi's policy framework or what his policy trust is, no, that's not true. It just going to, especially after he came back from his, you know, his diaspora tour, it was almost like he was responding clearly to that. Go and read his timeline. You can say that you don't like the medium through which he's communicating, that you want a document because your presidential candidate has commissioned a document 4 years ago that he's still using now. But if you go and read his Twitter timeline, you see very clearly in different areas, security, economy, I mean, it name it, it's all there. So you can then go and challenge him on the basis of what he has put out and say, and tell us why his plans don't make sense. Again, going back to the interview that he did, that was what, all of 8 minutes. He had to be very direct in making sure he gets his message across. In that kind of forum where you have only 8 minutes, it was about reach. You are on CNN to project. And that was why I was saying that, of course, he's had better interviews. Because all you are doing there, you're not going to be able to make any policy, land-breaking policy discussions, go into detail on what you are going to do. No, that's not the opportunity. If you get a one-hour special with Farid or with Christian Amanpour, maybe you can go into more detail. But how long was the conversation with Zinasha that will enable him to go? So he had to tell, with a wider reach, show that, yes, Nigeria has X, Y, Z problems. These are surefire ways for us to do it. These are my antecedents. This is what I bring to the table. Project, show that, yes, this is what I understand the problems, and these are the typical solutions I can bring to bear, and this is what I'll do. And he was very clear. And I'm with him 1,000%. I've been talking about this for 5 years. The biggest issue for Nigeria is economic. So when people tell me that, oh, they're asking him insecurity problems and he's bringing economic solution, it means that they don't even understand the issues that we have. Yes, there's no doubt about it that, yes, we have Boko Haram, we have banditry and all of that. But at the core of Nigeria's issue is the economic imbalance that we have in Nigeria. And so if you need to address that, you need to get the mass of Nigerians, that over 60% of our population that is in stark poverty, you need to shift that. You need to create jobs. You need to create an economy that is inclusive. You need to create, opportunities for people. And so when he talks about agriculture and talks about he repeated it, the vast lands in the north, we have to get people to work in. Security, we need to beef up our manpower and also put equipment, put intelligence behind it. When he talks about bringing civility into governance, bringing fiscal prudence into governance, that is what we need. We've seen the waste of the last 7 years. These idiots promised us that they were going to come in, I mean, and cut down the song of corruption. They were even telling us then that they were going to sell out the private jets. What has Buhari done? We need to get to a point where you slim down the government, you reduce the cost of governance, and you invest those monies into areas that would have a multiplier effect on the society. That's what he promises. Those are the comments that he makes. So when people say that he doesn't have a policy position, it's just funny to me. Those are things that you can hold him by. He's gone so far as to tell you that within 4 years he must increase power by 200%. I've challenged him and said it's not ambitious enough, because he was saying 5,000 megawatts that we do to 5,000 megawatts that we do today. He wants to take it to 15,000. I've told him it's not good enough, but even that will be a landmark in a country where we only have 5,000 today. That's a stated policy position that you can hold him to and say, if you don't deliver it, we will call you a failure. So the idea that until you give me a 800-page document or a something, no. Let's be clear. What are we looking, what are we asking for, and what is he offering? Could he have done better on the interview? Absolutely. And for me, it's more around style and making sure you come across as, you know, engaged. He didn't look as engaged, and I'm narrowing that because I've seen two instances. I'm narrowing it down to the virtual. He's someone that communicates off body language, feeds off of that. You just need to juxtapose two virtual interviews I've seen. Compare that to when he's in the same room with the people that he's conversing with.
Okay, I'd like to respond.
Oh, yes. No, you have. I'll give you 1 minute to respond.
I need more than 1 minute, but I'll be very quick. I need more than 1 minute, but I'll be very quick. When we speak about the house, we speak about, and I really like that you picked power as one of the examples. So the stated objective is 15,000 megawatts at the end of 4 years. So that's what the stated objective is. But we speak about the how, and it's a substantial chunk of information that is missing. So, for instance, the day when Alhaji Atiku Abubakar did his interview with Arise News, Arise TV, he tells you straight away that we're looking at breaking up the national grid. So the grid is one big monolithic thing that cannot wheel an increase in generation of power. So before you even begin to do increases in generation of power, how do you improve the grid? Okay, so we want to break it up, regionalize it. So that is a how. When he says that we want to diversify sources of power based on access to the various regions, and says maybe we can do hydro and so on in the vast open lands of the north, that is a how. When he says we will concentrate in the short to middle term in powering by gas areas around the Niger Delta where the vast gas reserves are, that is a how. So when we say that there is no how in Peter Obi saying the plans, you will not be able to speak to me now and pick up an interview where you say Peter Obi said this was how we're going to improve power. Atiku Abubakar has told you how. He's telling you, yes, we'll increase generation, but we've got to resolve the grid. So break the grid. You're not hearing that. That's the how that we're talking about. If we come down to those hows, my candidate is the only one who's saying how. And it doesn't matter whether you're saying policy document or not. He's actually saying to you, this is how we want to achieve this. If you want to push in criticism to my candidate's position, so you're asking, are you going to break the grid? Are you going to sell it off? Are you going to concession it? Are you going to sell it? He's not gotten into that extent of detail, but he's telling you straight away, this is how. Same thing. I mean, we could pick anything else. When we also talk about some of the places where these things are important to come out now, Peter Obi is running on the platform of organized labor. He is a capitalist inclined presidential candidate. Labor is socialist. There is an ideological difference there. So when he comes and says, I'm going to cut cost of government, we're looking and we're saying, okay, but your political party wants bigger government. Straight away, you have a fight on your hands. Even if you win from your political party, straight away. I could go further. Okay, my candidate is committed and says, we fuel subsidy needs to go. His party is aligned, fuel subsidy needs to go. Your candidate says fuel subsidy needs to go. But every time in the past that my party has tried to make fuel subsidy go, organized labor stands in the way. So the question is, if you get elected, your first fight is with your political party before you even come to the generality of the Nigerian people. How are you going to cut cost of government when your political party wants big government? How are you going to remove fuel subsidy when your political party wants fuel subsidies? You say we don't need a national carrier. Now, I don't know if he said so, but if we're keeping up on the theme of big government, it's on the Labour manifesto. They want a national carrier. They want a national everything. My candidate is saying part of the ways to reduce the size of government is to remove our hands from all those things and invite private sector participation. The political party for your candidate doesn't want government's hands out of those places. So immediately, how are you first and foremost going to fight your political party? Because you have to. And I'm saying, is it worth it? My own candidate and his political party are already aligned. We're already pro-capitalist. We're already pro-small government. We're already pro-fuel subsidy removal. We're already pro-so many things. And I'm wondering, okay, I'm not even wondering, I'm telling the Nigerian people, this is why you should vote my candidate over Peter Obi, because there's already an ideological alignment on this side. On Peter Obi's side, there's no ideological alignment. Alignment between Peter Obi and the Labour Party.
But that's not correct.
Let's give Phoenix 1-2 minutes and then we're done.
Let me explain because I know it is in your interest and PDP interest to try to paint the Labour Party as a socialist party. And I've been pushing back against it and trying to explain to you people because I think it's just difficult, or maybe out of mischief, because I know you know better. Their ideology is social democrats. That's what they are. And what that means is that they are left of center. Now, if people understand Peter Obi's ideology and how he operates, Peter Obi is right of center. And those who understand political alliances know that it is easier for people who are left of center to align with people who are right of center. Why? Peter Obi's aim is to open up the economy, create opportunities, create wealth to do social good. That's why he's always talking about investment in education, investment in healthcare, investment in security. He wants the economy to work, not just for working sake, because that's what you're trying to tell us. If you keep making this noise about capitalism, we will tell you how capitalism has destroyed certain social outcomes. He is saying, make the economy work for everyone, create opportunities, pull people out of poverty by having sound social outcomes. The Labour Party is founded on the basis of social democratism. And they are a left of center party. Go and read their manifesto. Go and read the document on the INEC website and see where they clearly state enabling private enterprise, but having oversight by government for the good of all. So it is not a socialist party by any means. There's no way you can ever justify calling Labour Party a socialist party. This is something that the PDP has been trying to sell to create that dichotomy between Peter Obi and Labour Party. It is not true. Secondly,
I will respond.
We all know that while Labour has over time pushed back against fuel subsidy removal, which I have always had a problem.
And smaller governments. Add this. And smaller governments.
Their issue. I don't know this one. You're talking about smaller governments. I'll pick on that point. But the issue around fuel subsidy that they've always raised is that you need to address what you will do for the people when you remove this fuel subsidy. That's what they've always said. And Peter Obi is saying that fuel subsidy must go. But for it to go, that there will be clear plans as to how you will address the pains that will come on the common man. So there's alignment in what they're saying. And we know that under Buhari, Labour actually took a step back and did not push back as much as they used to push back before on removal of subsidy. They did not make any noise. And when the fuel price was going up, they did not make any noise. So we know that Labour has shown that they are willing to support a government to remove subsidy. The question is, what kind of government are they willing to support? And what assurances do they want to see if this is done? So if we take Peter Obi's position and Labour's, what we have seen of them, then we're sure that it can work. If you talk about big government, please give me examples of big government. Yes, they said they want a national carrier. He says that there's no need for national carrier. There will be points of disagreement, and they will find alignment in certain instances. So this whole idea that Peter Obi's philosophy or his ideology is antithetical to the Labour Party, it is not true. It is not true.
Well, okay, I must.
No. He's had to write a response. One, I'll be short. I'll be brief. Okay. He's had to write a response.
One minute because of time.
Okay. 11, one so minute. Let me quickly say, right? One, on the issue of generating wealth at a national level, that people at the subnational levels, that's governors, and then, you know, in government, and then people across the country, nobody. Absolutely nobody in the top four presidential candidates, nobody amongst any of the presidential candidates in any of the political parties has participated in wealth generation at that level better than Alhaji Atiku Abubakar. Nobody. Between 1999 and 2007, As Vice President of the Federal Republic of Nigeria, as Chairman of the National Economic Council, he was directly involved in the creation of wealth on levels that none of the other candidates
have been involved in. I disagree with that.
But you know, I listen to you. Let me finish. We can always take this on. The numbers don't lie. The numbers are there. I think it was in 2001, maybe 2002, that we even did 15% annual GDP growth. But let's move from there.
Because I don't know.
I was disagreeing when you were talking. Let me finish yours.
That is what. Lemona, you have 1 minute.
I will finish now. Speaking about education and all that you said, remember that which government was it that passed the UBEC law, the Universal Basic Education Act? Who was it? It was Obasanjo and Atiku Abubakar. It was the Atiku Abubakar government, the Obasanjo government, in which Atiku Abubakar was number two, wasn't it? He's the person who's played. Again, this is where we talk about experience. It sort of matters. In the setting up of the framework that this country has, the man has played a very significant role. And to come back to your issues, Labour, at every time when government has said, let us cut down the size of government, Labour has been a very stiff opposition and said, no, we will not do so. But that's my point. That's the point. So when your candidate comes and says, hold on, we'll cut down the size of government, and his political party is saying, no, we will not allow you, there's no alignment there. That's what I said. There's no alignment there. Finally, when we now come to this issue of you have allowed me to forget the last point I wanted
to make.
This is not fair.
Unfortunately, you have to step in because our time is up. The listeners will reach their own judgment. They've heard both sides very clearly. But I must thank you, Ilemona, for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here. Thank you, Phoenix, for co-hosting. And last but not least, thank you to our listeners for taking time out of your busy schedules to be here, to listen to our podcast. Tomorrow, we're going to have a special podcast on the Benin Bronzes. There's going to be a debate about whether or not the Benin Bronzes should be returned to the royal family of Benin and how that should be managed. We're going to have David Frum, the prominent journalist and former speechwriter to President George W. Bush, is going to be on the podcast alongside Ikeloa Ikide, a prominent Nigerian poet and satirist, if I may say so. But until same time next week, or basically tomorrow, because we're going to do a special podcast tomorrow. So until tomorrow, as you have a fantastic evening.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Demona. Thank you,
listeners. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, everyone.
Have a great week. Bye, everyone.